You are listening to an audio recording of a book launch event hosted by the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C. The event took place on Tuesday, November 23, 2010, and featured remarks by the author, Bruce Bechtol. The name of the book is Defiant Failed State, The North Korean Threat to International Security.
Well, distinguished ladies and gentlemen and dear friends of KEI, I would like you to please be seated. We would like to welcome you here today to KEI on a very eventful day on the Korean Peninsula, also a very eventful day here at KEI. I am extremely pleased to introduce today's speaker, Dr. Bruce Bechtol, who is a former intelligence officer with the Defense Intelligence Agency, a retired Marine, who has lived and worked in Korea for many years and continues to visit there frequently. Dr. Bechtol received his doctoral degree from the Union Institute in Cincinnati, Ohio, and is currently an associate professor of political science at Angelo State University in Texas. He was previously faculty at both the U.S. Marine Corps Command and Staff College and the Air Command and Staff College. And he has also served as a visiting adjunct professor at the Korea University Graduate School of International Studies in Seoul, Korea, in 2006 and 2007. He is very well known as the author of Red Rogue, The Persistent Challenge of North Korea, published in 2007. He has been a contributing author to several books on North Korea, has written numerous articles on security on the Korean Peninsula, and is a former editor of the Defense Intelligence Journal. Today's event is very special. We will have an opportunity of discussing with Dr. Bechtol his latest book, Defiant Failed State, The North Korean Threat to International Security. I would have to say, unfortunately, this title is very timely today, and we look forward to listening to Professor Bechtol's remarks and presentation of his book. His remarks will take about 40 minutes. After that, we will have a question and answer session, giving our distinguished members of the audience an opportunity to ask Dr. Bechtol some questions. And we will conclude with a book signing. As most of you, or all of you, have noticed, there are copies of Dr. Bechtol's book available outside. They're available for $20 per copy. Dr. Bechtol will be available for a book signing. Without further ado, Dr. Bechtol.
Thanks, Greg. Can everybody hear me? Excellent. Before I get into this, I'd like to thank some people for having me here and for allowing me to be here. First of all, I'd like to thank my fellow faculty at Angelo State University, which is located in the beautiful Concho Valley in West Texas, and for the second year in a row was on Princeton's list of best colleges and universities in the country. So I'd like to thank them for supporting my scholarship, allowing me to leave in the middle of the semester and come out here. I'd also like to thank all the folks at KEI who helped put this together and have helped me numerous times in collaborations and support of my research. It's really been quite helpful. I have many friends here and family, including Kang Jung-un, who schlepped her way here with me from San Angelo, Texas, on a puddle jumper to Dallas-Fort Worth to Reagan International. So I'd like to thank her for being here. Our 16-year-old daughter is at home alone, and I'm just hoping we don't get home and find a kegger in the backyard. So anyone who knows my daughter knows she'd certainly not do something like that. But let me address this. So thank you all for having me here. It's certainly quite an honor to be here, not only with people I respect, but with people I respect who are my friends. So let me talk about this book. Why would I title this book Defiant Failed State? Well, my friend Moises Naim, who edits Foreign Policy Journal, which is the second most widely read international relations journal in the United States, they put out, he would tell you, many of the priorities, the check marks, if you will, for failed states. They put out what's called the Failed States Index every year, which many of you probably look at. And if you look at it, for the past 10 years at least, North Korea has been on that failed states index. They meet many of the paradigms for being a failed state. Well, they're still here. Not only are they still here, but they threaten many of the United States' interests at home and abroad, particularly with our allies, and not only our allies in Asia, that is to say South Korea and Japan. The things that they do, the threats that they pose to us, affect other important allies such as Israel in the Middle East, and I'll address that, and I talk about that in my book. So, before we get into the conversation, please allow me to ask three questions that I intend to answer in this presentation. One, is North Korea a failing or failed state? Two, is it capable of surviving indefinitely? And three, why and how does it present such risk to Asia and the United States and its allies? And I think this is very interesting, to me at least, still today, when I go to college campuses, and I've done that with some KEI people, I have students come up to me and say, but I saw a film of you know, stunted growth people and starvation and you know, crumbling infrastructure. All true, all legitimate, all relevant. But what we must understand is that often these situations exist because so much of North Korea's GDP, their resources, the stuff they struggle to get so much goes into building up the military and supporting the elite and the party. So interesting stuff. Which leads me to what I'll address here, which will be, how does North Korea's domestic, foreign, and military policy challenges, and the implications that this presents, how does that affect them maintaining power and projecting power in Northeast Asia and elsewhere? And I think the best way to address this is how I do it in my book. And I look at four key, basic, clear threats that North Korea presents to the United States and its allies. One, the North Korean non-nuclear threat. The threat from everything except their nuclear weapons, which gets less attention than just about anything on the Korean Peninsula unless something like what happens today occurs. And then suddenly people want to pull out the military experts and talk to them. I've gotten just a few phone calls this morning. The second threat, the North Korean proliferation threat, which is worse than many people realize, but is finally starting to get the attention that it deserves, both within policy and academic circles. Third threat, of course, is the North Korean nuclear threat. I want to talk about that because there were some things that happened over the weekend, but there was also some things that were in this book already that address all of that. And the fourth threat to regional security. And don't kid yourselves, it affects regional security for everybody who has an interest in the region, is North Korea's regime succession process and the instability and the potential instability that that could cause, and the operations plans it could cause us to have to initiate for you military guys in the audience. So I think these are worthwhile things to consider, and I'm going to talk about them today. So let's talk about what the challenges are for the North Korean People's Army. Let's talk about the non-nuclear military threat first. Inadequate resources, particularly food and fuel, limits training of traditional conventional forces. Now, what do I mean by traditional conventional forces? I mean tanks, trucks, planes, armored personnel carriers, et cetera. And they have a lot of them. The reason I was shuffling the pages was so I could read you the exact figures. 3,900 tanks, 2,100 armored vehicles, 8,500 field artillery pieces with 5,100 multiple rocket launchers. That's 13,000 artillery systems. 3,000 pontoon bridges. Now, why would they need so many pontoon bridges? Thinking. All of those systems need a lot of fuel to go out and train every year. And that's exacerbated by the fact that the North Korean military does not have simulators like the U.S. and NATO forces or the South Korean military does. So if you're a tank commander, if you drive a T-62 in North Korea, the way for you to train in that T-62 is in that T-62. And if you have fuel problems, that's an issue. Also, malnutrition problems and health problems have led to some discipline issues. The biggest one I can think of was back in 1995 when a whole corps, the 6th Corps, revolted, and Kim Jong-il, who had just come to power about a year and a half before, the way he responded to that was he brought a crack division from the DMZ up by train, killed a bunch of guys, purged all the officers out of the corps that hadn't escaped to China, where, by the way, they still sit today, and moved the 6th Corps to Wonsan, way farther down the middle of North Korea's landmass. The general who dissed his fellow officers, the commander, is now a high-ranking general and general staff and a member of the NDC. It's very interesting stuff. Food remains a problem, too. Not so much so for the military, but for the general populace. Inadequate force modernization programs. The last modern piece of military gear that the North Koreans got, they got in 1989, and it was MiG-29s. They got about 40 of them. They got Su-25s, which is a support ordnance-dropping aircraft, in 1988. They haven't got any new stuff since then. So basically what they have to do is keep maintaining the old stuff as South Korea and the United States continue to advance our systems. Of course, South Korea still flies F-5s, which went out of the Marine Corps inventory in 1986, so something interesting. Something that's also very interesting is that North Korea does not have sufficient GDP to engage in a traditional arms race with the ROK, because in my view, in many ways, there's a Cold War in miniature on the Korean Peninsula. Well, they can't engage in a traditional arms race with the ROK. The South Korean economy isn't double the size of North Korea's economy. It's dozens of times bigger than the North Korean economy. They don't have the money to compete with that. So they have to use other things and approach other ways. Finally, information is gradually beginning to seep in. And you guys have all, many of you know about the fact that cell phones have become a major way of getting information out. I talk about that extensively in my book. All big challenges for the North Koreans. Well, what's the answer to that? How do you, if you are North Korea and you've got a million-man army, fifth largest in the world, how do you answer all of these challenges? Well, the big answer, the way they've chosen to answer it, is with asymmetric forces. Asymmetric forces are the highest priority, and as traditional forces' capabilities continue to slowly decline, this remains their main focus. But their traditional forces continue to be maintained, and we'll talk about that later. The result that we have in North Korea is an evolving threat that keeps the status quo on the Korean Peninsula, but is extremely expensive to maintain, about 35%, according to many estimates, of North Korea's GDP. And that leaves us with a Cold War in miniature. Of course, North Korea has nuclear weapons, but little attention is paid to their other stuff, as I said before. The key three pillars of North Korea's asymmetric threat is their long-range artillery, their ballistic missile forces, and their special operations forces. And this allows the NKPA to threaten ROK and U.S. forces with affordability in ways that are highly difficult to maintain. In other words, the South Korean military is really, really, really well prepared to fight the 1985 NKPA. They're not so well prepared to fight asymmetric forces that the ROK has. They've got a lot of work to do. So looking at the first pillar of those asymmetric forces, let's talk about long-range artillery. North Korea has about 900 long-range systems, according to my good friend Joe Bermudez. About 300 to 350 of those systems can hit Seoul. 5 to 20% of these systems are assessed to be equipped with chemical weapons, and press reports indicate that more systems have been moved to the DMZ in the past year, A, and B, the survivability of the systems has been increased. And what they've done is, for many of these systems, if you've seen pictures in the NK Daily or other publications where they have these long-range guns sitting on top of a mountain, they've dug tunnels in these hills. They've backed the systems out through the tunnels and stuck them behind the hill so it's harder to hit them with counter-battery fire. So very interesting stuff. They have more systems now than they had a year ago. They had more 5 years ago than they had 10 years ago. At least 300 of these systems can hit Seoul now. So something to think about. 200,000 casualties on the first day, according to both DOD and MND. But when it comes to artillery and asymmetry, today, I think, or last night, I think shows us that North Korea is not just attaching asymmetry to long-range artillery, because we saw what happened. North Korea has the artillery capability to hit every single inch of those five UN-controlled islands in the northern limit line. And we saw them do it this morning, very early this morning, our time. Why do they have this capability? Well, this should come as no surprise to anyone. And some of you know we talked about that. I talked about this last February when they first fired these guns. in the past 18 months, North Korea has been preparing for exactly what they did this morning. Kim Kyok-shik, who is one of Kim Jong-il's most trusted advisors, was the chief of the general staff, and he was moved from being chief of the general staff to being a mere corps commander. What corps? Fourth Corps. Fourth Corps is the corps that borders the northern limit line. The commander of Fourth Corps controls those forces and, in fact, conducts liaison with naval and special operations forces who do things like sink the Chonan. So Kim Kyok-shik goes over there. As soon as he moved over there, we read in open sources that the North Koreans started moving dozens of artillery systems into Fourth Corps, many of them on the border with the water, many of them sitting on the water, I should say. Soon after that happened, in February of this year, we saw them conduct a live fire exercise where they fired at least 400 rounds up to a kilometer away from the northern limit line. And not only did they conduct a live fire exercise, but they did a time on target exercise, which is to say, Dave, I know you know what this is, probably nobody else does. A time on target exercise is you fire guns with different ranges at different times so that the shells impact at the same time. Those are time on target grills, and they're deadly. And the North Koreans did pretty good with it in the northern limit line area earlier this year. It will be interesting as we look at the results of this artillery firing today if that was a time on target attack or not. In other words, they'll be able to figure that out if they see when the shells landed and what type of shells landed. And no doubt that'll be part of the investigation. This is asymmetry. A year and a half ago, North Korea was not able to hit those islands effectively with artillery. Now they are. They are able to directly threaten and intimidate South Korean forces. And the latest figures I saw were 2 dead South Korean Marines, 18 wounded. I have not seen any figures on civilian casualties. The pictures from that scene are pretty compelling. It was a town. They targeted a town with civilians in it. Very interesting. So another part of North Korean asymmetry with artillery. North Korean ballistic missile threat. Excuse me. Pyongyang continues to hone the capabilities of the Taepodong 2. 2006, North Korea test fired the Taepodong 2. It went all the way through its first stage successfully and then crashed in what you Japanese reporters will be calling the Sea of Japan, what the rest of us will be calling the EC, crashed there, and everybody said, well, the Taepodong 2 doesn't work. Well, 2009, they tested it again. This time, the Taepodong 2 went all the way through its first stage, all the way through its second stage, 3,600 miles. And as it went into its third stage, then it tumbled into the Pacific Ocean, which we all call the Pacific Ocean. And people were saying, well, you know, as watching the pundits on the various networks, well, this was a failure. Well, yes, but it was more of a success than the last one, and it shows continued development, so we should keep that in mind. Another thing that's important is, and I'll talk about this when I talk about proliferation, as the North Koreans develop this technology, they share it with those people who pay them for it, that is to say the Iranians. So it's very likely that the Iranians have that Taepodong 1 and 2 technology. Also, talking about the Scuds and the Nodongs, a Scud missile, the North Koreans have several versions of that, ranging in capability from 350 kilometers to 850 kilometers. Well, what does that mean? It means they could target every single inch of the South Korean landmass, and stuff that they would have had to use a tank division or a tank brigade to take in the past, they'll just shoot a missile at it. So very interesting stuff. And what makes that capability all the more interesting is that according to Air Force, the National Air and Science Intelligence Center in Ohio, and ROC MND estimates, the North Koreans have up to 100 launchers for Nodongs and Scuds. So in other words, they could literally, in a war, launch Scuds, dozens of them, at South Korea, while they're at the same time launching Nodongs at Japan. So very interesting stuff. And they have a relatively new missile called the Musudan, also known as the Taepodong X, but now largely referred to as the Musudan, which is developed from old Soviet SSN-6 technology. It's a submarine launch ballistic missile, or it used to be. The North Koreans got some of them, or got one of them from the Russians, and being the smart guys that they are, they built a bunch of them themselves. Of course, they had to give it a longer range. So now it has a range of 4,000 kilometers and can hit Guam. Why is Guam important? Because Guam is where much of the air power that would fight in a Korea conflict would deploy from. Not only have they built and deployed those systems on mobile launchers, but they've sold 18 of them to Iran, who tested one successfully in 2006. So that's the ballistic missile threat. Let's get to my favorite North Korean member of the triad, Special Operations Forces. Special Operations Forces are the best trained, best fed, and most indoctrinated of NKPA military forces. They can attack through the air, through tunnels under the DMZ, by illegally entering the ROC, as those two majors did a few months ago to try and kill Hwang Jung-yup, or by maritime means, as we know from the Chonan. SOF forces, and this is important, have increased in numbers by 50% since 2006. They did this by taking seven conventional infantry divisions and converting them to light infantry divisions and changing their training cycle at the same time. We cannot mirror image, and we never should, because nobody's special forces are exactly like ours. And one of my best friends sitting in the audience is a special forces guy and will correct me if I'm wrong. But if we are to look at the closest thing to our special forces, the reconnaissance bureau guys, the sniper brigades, they're much like Delta Forces guys. The light infantry guys would more closely be related to our Ranger guys and perhaps Marine Corps Force Recon. They've got 180,000 of these guys, and it's grown by 50%. But the part of their special forces, and I talk about this a bit in my book, that I think is interesting right now because of current events, is their maritime special operations forces, because they do several things. One of them is infiltrate, as they've done very much. And in Japan for many years, their main reason for infiltrating was drug drops, I might add, methamphetamines mostly. But they also have submarines, such as the Yono-class submarine. And the Yono-class submarine is what ROC MND assesses in their 312-page study that they did with us, the Swedes, the UK, and Australia. It's what they assess sank the Chonan. What's interesting about that is that they've also sold lots and lots of those things to Iran. Why would they sell the Yono-class submarine to Iran? Well, the waters off the west coast of the Korean Peninsula are shallow. They're always tumultuous. The tides vary. Where else in the world is like that? Thinking off the coast of Iran. So they needed a sub that could work in those kind of waters. Ironically enough, the Yono seems to work real well in both kinds of waters. So seeing what they did with the Chonan for us Americans is also something we should keep in mind for any type of maritime interdiction off the coast of Iran. And I think that's very interesting. They also have semi-submersibles and all kinds of other things. But I think that gives an example of how capable their special operations forces are. Well, I've looked at three of the key asymmetric capabilities that North Korea has, that they've increased their capabilities in all three in the past 10 years and focused on that again since 2006. My assessment on that is that Pyongyang has cleverly adjusted its resources in order to focus on its asymmetric capabilities. And while some conventional capabilities continue to decline, albeit slowly, the asymmetric capabilities have actually improved in the past 10 years. Why is this important? Because gaps created in ROC and U.S. forces during the early days and weeks of combat could create openings for less capable but still highly deadly forces to take ground and cause heavy casualties. Now, why is that important? Because the North Korean Army in the past 15 years has made a concerted effort to place those more conventional forces on attack corridors. They've drastically increased the numbers of those forces that are on attack corridors. I actually have a map showing it in my book. North Korea has deployed its key armor, mechanized artillery, and infantry forces near these attack corridors. Probably about 7/10 of their military is on or near these corridors now. Very interesting stuff. So what does that mean for us? It means the tyranny of proximity. As General Ray Ayers, a good friend of mine who was the former J-5 in Korea, would call it. And what does that mean? The tyranny of proximity means North Korea will always be able to present more of a threat to South Korea because of the geographical terrain on the Korean Peninsula, both the maritime terrain and the land-based terrain. So something to keep in mind. Well, what's another? I've talked about the non-nuclear military threat from North Korea. Please allow me to talk about proliferation. We've got one of the premier experts on proliferation here sitting in the audience. I won't embarrass him, but he'll probably ask you a question. Probably be a good one, Larry. Many countries that they proliferate to. First of all, Syria. What do they proliferate to Syria? They built Syria's plutonium nuclear reactor, which was essentially Yongbyon in the Syrian desert. They proliferate chemical weapons to the extent that they actually go out and practice with Syrian soldiers on Syrian artillery that they bought from the North Koreans in complete mop gear. Every year they do this. And they've sold the Syrians every single kind of Scud. Scud B, Scud C, Scud D, extended range Scud, and lots of conventional weapons, tanks, trucks, small arms, etc. They actually built a chemical weapons factory for the Syrians, and they actually built a Scud D factory for the Syrians, the North Koreans did. So interesting stuff. How about Iran? Well, I guess the best way to summarize Iran would be all of the above, and a highly enriched uranium program, and other missiles besides Scuds, that is to say, Nodongs, which is called the Shahab 3 in Iran. That is to say, the Musudan, which is called the Shahab 4 in Iran. And conventional weapons such as Yonoh-class submarines. So very, very close, very tight relationship with Iran. As my friend Larry Nish has said, long-time analyst at Congressional Research Service, and I quote him in my book, their relationship with Iran is obviously the biggest and the longest standing of proliferation, of missiles at least, and of much other stuff as well. North Korea also proliferates ballistic missiles and conventional weapons throughout the Middle East, South Asia, and Africa. Such weird stuff as, in the early 2000s, selling Scud Cs to the United Arab Emirates. Last year, the South Africans, of all people, actually caught a shipment of T-55 tanks that were on their way to Central Africa from North Korea. They will sell anything to anybody who will buy their stuff or barter for it, as the Iranians do with some of it, with oil. And there are countries such as, well, for example, the Central African Republic. Who else is going to sell them tanks, you know? And I guess I'd ask the other question, who else is still making T-55 tanks? Jeez Louise, that's a really, really old tank. So interesting stuff. But proliferation to lots of people. This is a big part of what they do to support the military and the party. But wait, there's more. Let's talk about non-state actors, that is to say, terrorists. North Korea's support to terrorist groups that is proven involves weapons and training to the Tamil Tigers right up until they were destroyed by the Sri Lankan army. So when that happened, North Korea lost a customer. But they were buying everything from the North Koreans, everything from small naval craft to 122 artillery to 107 multiple rocket launchers, you know, to small arms, everything. North Korea continues to proliferate to Hezbollah. Right now, today, Hezbollah is firing rockets at Israel that were manufactured at least partially in North Korea, perhaps completely in North Korea. North Korean experts from the Korea Mining Development Company, or KMD, which is one of the front companies which is now on the sanctions list, also built the tunnels that made it so difficult for the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, to get at them in the 2006 war. The North Koreans built for them a complex underground compound that was literally square miles in size. And, again, the Korea Mining Development Company. Finally, another group, a terrorist group, that North Korea continues to collaborate today. They have North Koreans working with these people in Iran right now today, this second, is the IRGC, the Iranian Republican Guard Corps. Because the Iranian Republican Guard Corps, or the IRGC, not only supports terrorist groups such as Hezbollah and Hamas and others, but they also serve as the systems command, if you will. They support not just proliferation, but acquisition. So that's who North Korea sells their weapons directly to. And I also might add that a lot of the stuff that goes to Hezbollah goes through the IRGC first. Certainly, everything that they do for Hezbollah is paid for by the IRGC. So just something to keep in mind, if you will. Well, what's my assessment on how we can counter DPRK proliferation and support to terrorism? I would say UN sanctions must be enforced not only by U.S. and key allies, but by other U.N. members. And we have seen that happening more in the past 8 months or so, and good on them for doing that. I mentioned South Africa. The United Arab Emirates has jumped in. India has helped us out. These are not countries you think of that traditionally clamp down on North Korean illicit activities, but they have helped us, particularly in the past year. I think there also needs to be a renewed emphasis on PSI, and I think that's happening as well. We need to see improved training during exercises of member states, improved coordination, and during the PSI exercises, a focus on following the money, because that's key. You follow the money, you can get back to the originator. I would like to give a Bravo Zulu, which, as you know, in Morse code is da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, to our South Korean allies who actually hosted a large PSI exercise recently off the coast of Busan. This show, I mean, this is very symbolic, if nothing else, but it also shows South Korea is doing what they need to be to help us out with PSI. And that goes along with having the ROC, Japan, and other key allies in Asia work with us on PSI. Now, along those fronts, I would say we must go after North Korean front companies, networks in friendly nations, and individual North Koreans known to support proliferation and illicit activities. Now, we're doing that somewhat. For those of you who've been following this, you know that we have been piecemeal adding more companies. Oh, yeah, we're going to add these companies. Okay, now we add these names. Come on. I think that more names, more companies, everybody who's suspected of supporting these illicit and illegal activities needs to be on that sanctions list. I think that's very important. North Korea also, in my view, needs to be relisted on the State Department list of nations supporting terrorism. Why do I think this? Well, because North Korea is a nation that supports terrorism. It's not that complicated. And until we put them back on the list of nations supporting terrorism, they're getting away, literally, with conducting activities that are hurting our security and the security of our allies. And the evidence that they're supporting terrorism, these non-state actors, is very compelling. So something to think about. Well, that's proliferation. Proliferation is the number two threat that I look at in this book. And there's a whole chapter on what I just talked about in much more detail. Let me talk about the nuclear program, if I may. I know that there was a speaker here this morning who talked about it, who actually toured their facility, their HEU facility, recently. Let me talk about how they will deal with us, and my views are probably different from some of you. I believe that North Korea will manipulate negotiations, any negotiations, including six-party talks, to obtain aid while agreeing in principle, to dismantlement. But in the end, they will prevent inspection regimes from accessing hidden components of their programs, unless, as they did a few days ago, they felt it was strategically in their interest to do so. But North Korea will always end cooperation at the point where vital program elements are threatened, but significant aid has been acquired. Well, what's their capability in the nuclear market? Please allow me to make this clear. They have at least 6 to 8 plutonium weapons. Some people say 15. They likely have or will have soon HEU weaponization. HEU is the most likely warhead for a missile because we know that they have the design for highly enriched uranium missile, a 500-kilogram highly enriched uranium design that they got from the Pakistanis. Why do we know this? Because when the Libyans gave up their program, they gave us the designs. And, of course, they had Chinese written on them, and Urdu and some other things. And they got them from the AQ Khan network, written in English, too. But this design is for a 500-kilogram warhead for a missile. Now, what kind of missile can carry a 500-kilogram HEU weapon? The answer is a Nodong, Alex. The Nodong missile can carry a 500-kilogram warhead, which means that if North Korea, if they don't already, has developed or will develop soon a highly enriched uranium program, they can hit Tokyo with a nuclear weapon, or alternatively, Camp Schwab, for example, on Okinawa. So very interesting stuff. So, it's interesting that Dr. Hecker was able to disclose that he actually walked through the facility. I think that's good. But all that that is really, in my mind, is yet another piece of evidence showing us what most of us should already know, that North Korea has a highly enriched uranium weaponization program, and if it ain't ready, it's going to be soon. Now, let me read you something from my book that talks about just that, because I spend about 12 pages in the book going through the HEU program. Here's what I say at the end. Experts in South Korea have reported that a completed highly enriched uranium facility, such as the one at Soweit-E, which is the other facility we know about, could produce one or two nuclear devices per year. Based on the evidence presented, this program is far beyond the R&D stage and may be close to, if not already, producing HEU weapons. In fact, it is my assessment that North Korea is likely to conduct a test of an HEU device when the leadership feels the geopolitical situation warrants it. So I would just ask you folks to think about that, because we appear to be getting fairly close to that situation. And I think it's a distinct possibility that if they have an HEU device, they're going to test it in the fairly near future. Well, let's talk about what many of you have had as your pet rock issue for the past 18 months or so now, the Kim Jong-il regime succession process. That's the fourth threat to stability and security of the Korean Peninsula and, of course, our key allies. Everybody knows that Kim Jong-il has three sons. His oldest son is named Kim Jong-nam, nicknamed the Fat Bear. And anyone who's ever seen a picture of Kim Jong-nam knows exactly why he has that nickname. His head's probably about as big as those two doors put together. His second son is Kim Jong-chol, who, again, as many of you probably know, is not from the same mother as Kim Jong-nam. And according to Kim Jong-il's Japanese chef, his father considers him, and I'm quoting, too much of a girly man to take over the North Korean regime. Kim Jong-chol reportedly is a big Eric Clapton fan and was a groupie following him around Western Europe a couple years ago, and he really likes computers, and he reportedly also has the same ailment, for those of you who saw the movie Fight Club, had the same ailment that Meatloaf had in that movie, for those of you who saw the movie Fight Club. In other words, he has to take hormones just to be more male than I guess he is. At least that's the reporting. Well, those are his first two sons, probably not who we would expect to see as the leader of the DPRK. His third son, Kim Jong-un, also from the same mother as Kim Jong-chol, as most of you know. He's 27. I have never seen a guy looking so uncomfortable as I saw him looking in those parades at the end of September. That was one dude that looked uncomfortable. And something else I think is interesting, for those of you who follow North Korea a lot, which is probably most of you in this room, he looks a lot like his grandpa, doesn't he? Kim Jong-un looks a lot like Kim Il-sung. He also has a name, the same name as my wife, because my wife's name is Kang Jong-un. So apparently in North Korea, the name Jong-un is the same as Pat or Chris would be here. But anyway, he is 27 years old, soon to be 28. Why is this a concern? Well, you know, he's got 70-year-old corps commanders, guys in the general staff that are the younger guys that are 68, 67 years old. Since 1948, since there was a DPRK, the way that that has been ruled is one-man rule. You got one guy in the middle, and all of the institutions feed into him. It was that way under Kim Il-sung. It's that way under Kim Jong-il. And the government simply cannot run any other way. So you have the security services, the party, the military, and then those 10 or so people in the inner Kim family circle that feed into the guy. If something happens and that guy, whoever it is, apparently it's going to be Kim Jong-un now, that guy cannot control, in fact, be the power broker in each one of those institutions, they will start to slowly fall apart, and that will lead to implosion. And I think the chances of that happening in North Korea are at least 50-50. And therefore, United States military personnel and South Korean military personnel need to plan accordingly. And just so you know, they are. Now, I lay out my biggest chapter in this book is the Kim Jong-il regime succession process, but I also have a whole chapter on the ROK-U.S. military alliance and how they are preparing for the different North Korean threats. And this is one of them. Yes, it's a threat if that regime implodes, and it's a threat to everybody who has interest in the region. So I hope you'll enjoy that when you read it. And that is all I have, except I hope I can enjoy signing many books with you all after we're done with the Q&A session.
Dr. Bechtol, thank you very much for a very comprehensive presentation. For a very comprehensive presentation of the challenges and threats we're facing on the Korean Peninsula, from the asymmetric threats to the North Korean proliferation threat, the North Korean nuclear threat, and the challenges and threats implied in the ongoing regime succession process. We are now going to open our discussion to questions. Larry?
People in our age bracket move to the Sun Belt, we tend to get mellow in our viewpoints. And I'm glad to see that this is not happening with you at all. But more seriously, I want to ask you about today's incident in two contexts. Number one, seems to me that the two things that really concern me about the situation off Korea's west coast is that, number one, we have seen now three major incidents within a year. The time space between these North Korean provocations out there seems to be shortening as compared to a few years ago when you had perhaps 2 or 3 years between these incidents. And then, of course, the military intensification of these North Korean acts is going up as well. Looking at the North Korean regime, and I guess partly in terms of power structure and the succession process, where do you think, or who do you think is pushing the buttons towards this intensification of these incidents and this pressure off the West Coast?
That is a great question, Larry. And ultimately, of course, excuse me. My wife thinks I should quit smoking. What does she know? Ultimately, that was a joke. Ultimately, when one gets to military incidents, especially when dealing with North Korea, you have to get to the origination of them. Where did it come from? And we know from defectors, I'm sure you've talked to the same guys I've talked to, or many of them, or maybe more of them. Even those little incidents along the DMZ, you know, where two rounds are fired across the DMZ and then the rocks fire back that have now happened dozens of times since the armistice, even those are initiated on the order of Kim Jong-il. That's what defectors tell us. So obviously, something like the Chonan, for example, or this artillery firing that happened this morning in Korea, or the live artillery firing, which went almost as far as this one did earlier this year when Larry and I talked before. These are all initiated at the very top. Now, I think what you want me to go farther than that, though, and address who's advising Kim Jong-il to do these kinds of things. And I think that gets back to the gentleman I mentioned earlier and why he was put in the position he was put into, General Kim Kyok-shik, who is one of Kim Jong-il's most trusted confidants. And actually took what in most countries would be a demotion. It would be like in the United States going from being the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to some guy commanding a corps at Fort Benning, for example, literally like that. But he did that because he wanted one of his most trusted guys running the show out in Fourth Corps where all this NLL stuff is happening. So I think he's advising him. I also think Okuk-yul, his boyhood friend, is playing a big role in advising him. Okuk-yul is now on the National Defense Commission. He is one of three that I know of, well, one of two now because Chung Myung-rok is dead, but he is one of what is now two vice chairmen on the National Defense Commission, Chang Sung-taek being the other one. I think he's advising a lot on these military things, especially because he's an old recon bureau guy. I mean, he ran the operations department for 30 years in the party, which was basically a redundant force much like the reconnaissance bureau, special operations forces type stuff. So I think he's advising on a lot of this stuff that's happening in the NLL. And if I may, Larry, if I could just touch on something that I think is hugely important. This morning, as my wife and I were in a hotel room and I was trying to eat my bagel and cream cheese, which, as you know, is Jewish soul food, and talk on the phone at the same time, I heard a lot of stuff coming out of pundits, you know, all this strategic stuff. Let me get to the crux of one of the ways you need to address a tactical issue like an artillery attack on an island. And it's really not that complicated. Artillery officers, aviators, infantry officers have checklists. And those rules of engagement are very strict. The same thing works for our troops in Afghanistan and Iraq right now. In other words, they need to have very, very strict and unambiguous rules of engagement for the military officers leading those troops on those five UN-controlled islands and the maritime forces as well. In other words, you're a Marine Lieutenant Colonel, a ROC Marine Lieutenant Colonel, and you get artillery fire. You need to have a checklist that says, I get artillery fire, I fire back at this azimuth. In 30 seconds, I call for air support from KF-15s. In other words, that checklist has to be there. And if it's not, that means reaction time can be slower than it should be. And I think we may have seen some of that this morning. So that's one way that the ROC military can really work on that. And along those lines, I have to say, I've worked with ROC Marines before. They're the best there is. Those guys are just, they are really good. So, I mean, they get a checklist. They will follow that checklist. And I fear for the North Koreans that attack them again. Does that answer your question, sir? Thanks.
DJ Han.
DJ Han from British American Security Information Council. You mentioned counterfire, and you mentioned that there is the work to be done on U.S. and South Korean side. And referring that, do you see that the relocation of the American unit and as well as this transfer of operational control is in line with our current situation? Do you think it wouldn't harm the unity of the command? That's my first question. And my second question goes on, the South Korea has not participated in the missile defense of the United States because of the tyranny of the proximity that you described. And I believe they installed the Hyunmoo, which is the long-range missiles. Wouldn't this kind of reaction preparation of South Korea be helpful in terms of dealing with asymmetrical challenges?
Both very good questions. Thank you, sir. If you have not, I talk a lot about OPCON transfer in my book. I am a absolute black and white proponent of pushing it back from 2012 and wrote that a lot and spoke on it and angered a whole lot of generals on that, Americans. Of course, the retired ROC generals love me, so it was good and bad. But I'm a strong proponent and continue to be a strong proponent of the need to push back wartime OPCON. Why? Really, it's really simple. The ROC military simply will not be ready to do the things that they're going to be expected to do by 2012. Will they be ready by 2015? Perhaps not, but they'll be more ready than they would have been in 2012. And you know what? If we have reasonable men in Changhwade, the Blue House, and in the White House, then they can sit down and talk as that time approaches and work it out again, just as Im Myung-bak and President Obama did. And I think people from both countries should be proud of our presidents for doing that. That took a lot of guts for both those guys to do that, and it was the right thing to do. So we'll have to see how you know, it all depends on budgets and, you know, development and acquisition, how close the South Koreans get. But we need to work together on this issue very closely as 2015 approaches. So good question. Second part, ROC BMD. The ROC, excuse me, the South Korean, the ROK military forces need to integrate with the U.S. ballistic missile defense system, period. Stop talking about it. Do it. The Japanese have already done it. You guys need to do it. The Japanese already have a ballistic missile defense far superior to yours, and you have a far bigger threat than they do. It's something that needs to be done, and right away. The number one mission of a president of a liberal democracy, as Im Myung-bak or anybody else in South Korea is defense of the state. Everything else is second after that. And in order to defend his state, he needs to get sufficient ballistic missile defense, and he needs to integrate that ballistic missile defense with the United States. And what that means is they need to buy PAC-3s, PAC-3 Patriot systems that are capable of shooting down North Korean Scuds. They need to buy SM-3 ballistic missile defense systems that they can instantly put on their King Sejong-class destroyers. They already have a ship that can carry it, so that they can shoot down North Korean Nodongs. And they need to get working on that right now. That's my opinion. Well, I've heard that theory. Well, and what this gentleman's talking about is a theory of, well, you know, the Scud has such a short flight time from North Korea into South Korea that, I mean, we won't have time to destroy it with a PAC-3. It's not true. PAC-3 can destroy it. Let me explain to you guys who don't study missiles all the time, and I'm not a missile expert, but the difference between a PAC-2 and a PAC-3 is when a PAC-3 shoots up in the air to shoot down a missile, it's like a shotgun blast. When a PAC-3 shoots up in the air to shoot down a missile, it's one shot, one kill, as Marines would say. It's killing a bullet with a bullet. It's much more accurate, and you have a much better shot at shooting it down. The SM-3 would be for missiles that fly at a higher trajectory, like the Nodong. And the North Koreans would probably attack different parts of Gyeonggi Province with different ranges of Scuds. But they would probably also attack places like Busan and Gwangju and Jeju-do with Nodong missiles set on a different trajectory. So they need both. They need both. And they're very expensive, very expensive. But this is something you all need to start looking at right now, in my opinion.
We're just going to take three questions together. We'll go to Ms. Nicole Finneman, KEI first, then Professor Catherine Withersby Sice, then Mr. Iha Won of the Joseon Ilbo.
Bruce, thank you so much. I would like to ask you a question about the events of early this morning. You mentioned that they've been preparing for this essentially for the last 18 months and that they had this capability now, whereas before they didn't necessarily, at least a year and a half ago, wouldn't have been able to do it. I wonder if you could address, as the world is speculating like mad what happened and before we get the investigation results, the gray area of the northern limit line and the possibility or if you believe there's a possibility, it's a very tense situation and anything could happen as an accident, or if this is a deliberate plan from the beginning event. And there's just a lot of talk about that today, if you had thoughts on it.
How could this be an accident? They fired 80 rounds into a village.
The beginning, I'm sorry. It's a really tense environment, and if you could address the northern limit line, is it black and white in your opinion? I mean,
well,
is it possible?
You know, in North Korea, firing rounds at the South Koreans when you're not supposed to means you go to a prison camp or you're executed. It's just there's no they don't have a sense of ha-ha about that. So I would say this was a deliberate act, and it was something that many of us who are military specialists, guys like Dave Maxwell and I, we were watching them get ready for this and talking about it and writing about it. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, for most academics in the Korean studies field, nuclear weapons is really sexy, you know, and it's really simple and easy to understand. It's groovy, it's diplomacy. Military stuff just is not sexy, and nobody's ever accused me of being a sexy guy anyway, except Mrs. Bechtel. But I'm telling you, it's just people, this thing happened in February. Some of us talked about it, you know, in symposia, et cetera, wrote about it. It's in the book, and then most people forgot about it. It is a big deal. Moving a lot of artillery to a coastline and pointing it at basically indefensible islands is a big deal. So, you know, as I said, the rocks have a way to counter this if it happens again. But they need to be very careful about it. And the thing that's interesting about the North Koreans, if I could point this out, is their modus operandi is they almost always have plausible deniability, like they did with the Chonan, but what they don't have this time. But the other thing that's interesting about the North Koreans is their TTP, their tactics, training, and techniques, and procedures almost always change. So we saw the Chonan, right? We saw the Chonan March 26th. Now we saw this. So my question is, you know, now everybody's getting ready for, you know, Everybody's doing ASW, anti-submarine warfare. Everybody's now getting, making sure they have counter-battery fire ready. What's the next incident going to be? Is it going to be artillery? Is it going to be a submarine? It could be something we've never seen before. In fact, I'd say it's fairly likely it may be something we haven't seen before. And this is the cleverness of the North Koreans. Hope I've answered your question.
Great. Professor Withersby.
Thank you. All of your comments so far, the very useful information you've presented, particularly about who is advising Kim Jong-il and the sequence of the preparations for recent actions, beg the question then of, you know, what is the reasoning behind these actions? Are they trying to demonstrate their strength so that people will take them seriously? Are they trying to demonstrate that so that other countries of the region will come to the negotiating table and they can get something for giving up something? What is your sense of the reason behind this morning's attack and recent provocations?
Where are all those? That's a good question, Catherine. Thank you. And Catherine and I are good friends. I'm a huge fan of her research, as she knows. If all these events that we've seen happen since January, the end of January 2010, as Larry remarked, have occurred in the same general area, the northern limit line area, and I think this reflects the fact that the NLL is Kim Jong-il's pet rock. This has been a big deal to Kim Jong-il since 1999. When I was a much younger man, I had much more hair, and I was an intelligence officer at our nation's Defense Intelligence Agency, was when ROK and North Korean ships were essentially ramming each other across the NLL. That's the extent it was going, and it was getting worse and worse, and there was sort of a ramming incident where a North Korean guy fired a round at the South Koreans, and they sank the ship, like, bam, just sank it. Since that time, the NLL has been his pet rock, the 2002 incident. All the incidents that occurred between then and 2008. And then in 2008, and I think this is interesting, and perhaps you and others might have some insights into this. In 2008, as Kim Jong-il's health deteriorated, in other words, he had his stroke, and soon thereafter, the North Koreans started focusing on the northern limit line again. I mean, focusing on it, not just going out and doing some things, but, you know, raising cane at Panmunjom, you know, moving artillery there, changing command there to put Kim's most trusted guy there. So they obviously decided, I think, that this is Kim Jong-il's main focus. So Kim Jong-il's been sick. We're going to do this to show that he's still a powerful leader. And at the same time, we'll be able to continue to intimidate our neighbor to the south. And, you know, they put South Korea in a very difficult position, Catherine, because you know all this. I mean, you know this as well as anybody in the room. Unless South Korea had reacted instantaneously, like within an hour, now they can't do something. Because they're a democracy, and world opinion will go, what are you doing? What are you doing going in there and just bombing targets in North Korea? You can't do that. That's not responsible. So the way for them to get past that, as I said before, is really to have that checklist, to be able to respond instantly. Because if they don't, it'll be just like the Chonan. It'll be just like this thing is today. I would be very surprised. I could be wrong. I would be very surprised, unless they do something today, if South Korea conducts a violent retaliation against North Korea, because they have that pressure from the international community that they have to respond to, being a democracy, obviously, and that North Korea does not have to respond to. Does that make sense to you? Thank you, ma'am.
Right. Mr. Lee Hawan next.
Thank you. Bruce, after North Korea made the attack, artillery fire on Yeonpyeong Island, already 12 hours passed, so I think it is somewhat late to make a counterattack. So what do you think most feasible response in this time? And what kind of action should we expect from the United States? Do you think there is any possibility that United States send an aircraft carrier to West Sea or East Sea again in the near future? Thank you.
If I was the national security advisor to the president, which I will never be, and I'm perfectly happy with that because the steak in Texas is better than here anyway, But if I was a national security advisor to the president, right now I'd be telling him, sir, we need to do an exercise in the West Sea, and we need to put a carrier in there. And we need to do that right now to send a message. Because that shows not only do we, as long as the South Koreans agree to it, because I think that the answer to this question is the South Korean government needs to take action, and we need to show that we're a supporting ally. So if South Korea asked us to conduct another exercise in that area, which, by the way, was what was going on there 12 hours ago, the South Koreans were conducting an exercise there. That the North Koreans claimed this was a retaliation for an exercise that crossed their sovereign waters, et cetera. We, I think, should send an aircraft carrier to the West Sea. Does that answer your question, sir?
Mr. Peter Kong?
Just to continue the same argument about retribution, you know, revenging North Korean attack this morning, early this morning. The South Korean Navy already, you know, under the rule of a battle, they attacked the source of, you know, attack, the artillery bunkers. Is that really, you know, what does that mean? If you want to revenge, it has to be something that will hurt Kim Jong-il, make him suffer. You know, when they attack us, South Korea suffers greatly. If we attack the artillery, you know, places, a few people might die. Kim Jong-il doesn't care about the lives, you know, being killed there. So, and also, you know, sending, you know, aircraft carrier, they have done that before, East Sea and West Sea both. What does that do unless we do something, you know, exercise? North Korea doesn't care if we do exercise. I mean, of course, that's better than nothing. But we have to do some substantive, you know, punishment against North Korea. Otherwise, North Korea will just keep doing it.
See, this is the dilemma, Peter. I mean, Peter Kong, one of my good friends again. I absolutely agree with you. The United States and South Korea are not rogue nations, and North Korea is a rogue nation. Therefore, they will do things that we cannot. And one of the things that we always have to do as a democracy, and the South Koreans always have to do, whether there's a guy from the GNP, Hanara, or a guy from one of the many left of center parties, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat in the White House, we have to do that thing that diplomats call an appropriate response. So I mean, they got an artillery attack on literally, I'm sure you've seen the pictures of Smoking Town, Peter. They got an artillery attack on a town. South Korea is not going to attack a town in North Korea. Because they're not a rogue nation. They can't do that. That's why they are now pretty much boxed in, where if they are going to do a response, it would have to be against the artillery positions that fired on them. That's really, in my mind, the best thing you can do. To do something else, to attack, for example, a command and control bunker in Pyongyang, that would start a war. Does that make sense to you? I mean, it really puts our governments in a dilemma, because this was a rogue attack. It was limited, and now it's done. And now the North Koreans expect us to huff and puff, but eventually forget about it, because that's what's always happened in the past. Go ahead, sir. Thank you.
Yes, please. David. Hey, Bruce, can you go back to the OPCON, or the myth of the OPCON transfer, and talk a little bit about...
No, okay. I'm kidding. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Just to correct the record, and talk a little bit about command and control of ROK and U.S. forces, and debunk the myth of the OPCON transfer, and tell us what it really means about dissolution of Combined Forces Command.
Well, that's a great question. Dave already knows the answer to it. Dave helped build it. Dave is one of the best planners on Earth, particularly when it comes to the Korean issue. But and I do not exaggerate. But let me talk about what OPCON is, what CFC is. OPCON transfer means that in wartime, when the ROK JCS, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, advises his president of it, his national command authority of it, and when we all agree, designated ROK forces, CHOP, to Combined Forces Command, which currently is commanded by an American four-star general. In his role as the commanding general of Combined Forces Command, that general answers to both the South Korean and the American national command authorities. In addition, at any time that the South Koreans are not happy with the way he's commanding those forces, they can pull their forces out. So all that CFC is commanding, the commander of CFC, he is commanding a combined military command under two national command authorities. It is in no way a violation of ROC sovereignty. And further, if we are to say that it's a violation of ROC sovereignty, then NATO is a violation of British sovereignty and Dutch sovereignty, because they have almost exactly the same arrangement, except it's not a bilateral agreement. It's a multilateral agreement. Does that make sense to you?
So it's really the dissolution of combined forces.
Exactly. Absolutely.
That's what we're talking about.
In fact, when I had a class 3 years ago. Every year when I was at Marine Corps Command and Staff College, I taught an elective on Korea and Japan. And one of the classes that I have is about military alliances in East Asia, primarily Japan and South Korea. And I had a Japanese officer in my class, and he's like, geez, wow, how come we can't have this like the ROCs have with you guys? They got the best command relationship they could have. And at the same time he's saying that, the president at the time of South Korea was saying, this violates our sovereignty, we need to get rid of it. You know, interesting stuff.
Thank you. We'll go next to Mr. Chuck Downs, HRNK.
Thanks. I guess I don't need to introduce myself. Bruce, I think the headline story out of this session is your comment that a year and a half ago, as Nicole pointed out, a year and a half ago, North Korea could not have hit these islands in this way. That puts this action by North Korea in the category of a demonstration of new technology, and there's a certain category in dealing with North Korea that we are used to, because they do this from time to time. 1998, the Taepodong, 2006, the nuclear test. There is a pattern there. So this may, in a way, fit into that pattern. I'd love to hear you give what you think would be the Pentagon's briefing today on what happened last night, but that's expecting too much, I think. When we do hear the Pentagon briefing on what they saw happen in these islands, what should we all be watching for in order to understand exactly what kind of new capability they're demonstrating?
Well, I think what we need to good question, Chuck. I think what we need to understand is that Waipido, Yeonpyeongdo, is only one of five islands. So they could fire on any of the other islands. There's four more they could fire on, so that's one thing. The other thing is these are old guns that are firing. I mean, you know, 1950s, 1960s, vintage guns, 76-millimeter guns, 130-millimeter guns. That's a long-range gun, not as long as some of the long-range guns I talked about earlier. But these guns are old, so it's not like they developed new technology. What they did do is beef up an area where they knew they could inflict casualties on the South Koreans, because there's no Americans on those islands. And they did. And they did it deliberately, decidedly, slowly. It took them 18 months to build up for this. They did an exercise first, you know, where they fired real close to the islands but not quite across the line. And I think this shows that they know exactly what they're doing and they're going through a planning process. Now, in the Pentagon, I'm quite sure, nobody's told me this, I'm just quite sure that there are experts at both USFK and DIA in the Pentagon who looked at what happened in late January, early February of this year and said, wait a minute, this is significant. And that the chairman, our own chairman, and Secretary of Defense, that they knew this capability and they knew that it was something they needed to worry about, as did the ROCs and the folks at USFK.
Mr. Mark Jarvis.
You kind of left us dangling at the very end of your remarks with a 50-50 chance of a new collapse. And like that was bad. People were higher, actually.
Great point.
You think odds are that high? number two, for second question, unrelated. You mentioned about sanctions that could be imposed. And if you think about the financial sector, where we last really seemed to get sanctions, how much room do you think we have left to go out? What's left in terms of that?
Great questions. Let me answer the first one. You made a great point, because for those of us who are as old as I am, and I'm really old, I'm 50, I was around as an Intel weenie in 1993-94 in D.C. when Kim Il-sung died. And some of my friends here in the audience were too, and remember that time frame. A lot of people thought, well, Kim Jong-il just won't have the gravitas to be able to hold it together, and you know, how strong will things be, and how much will he be tested? That's what you're talking about, basically, right? A lot of that occurred. Well, Kim Jong-il did what Kim Jong-il is still doing. Since that time frame, he's had five purging periods where he just, I don't know if you're against me or not, but you're dead. I mean, they've had huge purging periods in North Korea, including right after he took over the power. And the other thing that's interesting to consider about that, and this is why I get to the 50-50 thing, Kim Jong-il had 20 years to build up his power base. Kim Jong-un started building his power base about 9 months ago. If his dad dies soon, it's going to be very difficult for him to replicate the power base that his father built. And that's why I give him a 50-50% chance, which could become significantly enhanced if his father lives a long time and can help him build a power base. Does that answer your question for the first part? It is a one-person system. I would think not. It is all those agencies feed into each other. For example, let me discuss. Do I have time? Let me just discuss the Army. I see in a lot of press stuff how the Army will do this and the Army will do that. Well, please allow me to describe. Again, it's in the book. Allow me to describe to you how the North Korean People's Army works. At every level, from Corps Commander, or from MPAF, all the way down from Corps Commander, Division, Regiment, Battalion, Company, if you're planning an exercise or you're planning out your plan of the day, you got a guy over your left shoulder who works for the GPB, okay? And that was the service run by Cho Myung-rok, and now is run by his deputy, former deputy. If you got over your right shoulder, you got a guy from the State Security Department looking over you. Everywhere you go, everything you do. So you have these operational soldiers, and then you got a redundant counterintelligence and, for lack of a better term, counter-politically correct, because that's what the GPB does, General Political Bureau. They are just making sure that North Korean officers are politically correct in their mind. Everything you do, you have those guys looking over your shoulder. No gatherings of field grade officers, more than three, that don't have a representative from the GPB and the SSD there, which literally means in the North Korean People's Army, nobody commands, and it's a Confucian society, nobody commands the loyalty of more than one corps. So you're not going to take over the country with a corps. What you may have is a civil war, guys, you know, in a Byzantine-like fashion trying to jostle for power. That is why a junta is so difficult to run, a military junta for one thing, because none of the military guys trust each other. And you've got these political officers and you've got these operational officers. Another thing to point out is the Organization and Guidance Department, which sits in party headquarters, Division 4 and Division 13 deal with military officers in the military people's armed forces. You don't get promoted to the rank of brigadier general or above unless it's approved by the Organization and Guidance Department in the party. So people who think it's just the military running the show, that's just not the case. It's the party as well. So any junta would have to include these guys from the party who don't trust the guys from the military. Let's take it one step further. The security services are many and they are redundant. There are security services that monitor the military. There are military security services that monitor the civilian security services. There are civilian and military services that monitor the military and the civilian security services. And then there are security services that monitor other security services. This is a very redundant system that Kim Jong-il set up, and they don't trust anybody, and nobody trusts them, but they are a power base in the country. These guys feed into one guy. This is not a system that I think it would be easy to have a junta. I'm not saying it's not possible. I'm just saying it's not likely. Does that make sense? Okay, now two was your question about? I think there are still sanctions. If you follow the sanctions as I have, it was last summer we're listing these companies and these people. Then a few months later is we're listing these countries and these people. Now last week we're listing these people. Come on, just list them all right? I really think sanctions need to be focused and increase in their largesse. Is it affecting North Korea? Because I've heard people say the sanctions are not affecting North Korea. Oh, they are affecting North Korea, very much so. And it's important that we do this. But I think it's also important for people to understand North Korea is more skillful at getting around sanctions than probably any other nation state on Earth because they've been having to do it for so long. When that shipment that was caught in Thailand, do you remember that? 35 tons of military gear was caught in Thailand. It had been on manifests from five different countries, and one of the countries it was on the manifest for was New Zealand. Now, I'm not saying New Zealand wants to sell, small arms to Hezbollah, because that's where that stuff was going, a lot of it. But the fact that the North Koreans were able to find some business guy in New Zealand to deal with him just boggles the mind and shows that their TTP, their tactics and procedures, et cetera, for their proliferation makes it very difficult for even the best of sanctions to work. So it's important, I think, that we make sure that we're expanding these as much as possible. Does that make sense to you, sir?
Great. Dr. Bechtol, we are running out of time, so let's take the three, let's bundle together the next three questions. The young lady in the back, the gentleman next to her, and yes, sir. And we'll take two more afterwards.
Good afternoon. I'm Catherine Schaefer. I'm a cyber analyst, and my question has to deal with North Korea's military modernization. You said that they don't have the GDP to get into an arms race. And so my question is if you could address the North Korean cyber capabilities as a possible asymmetric threat and a force multiplier.
Excellent question. I've been asked that recently. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Please.
I got it. No problem.
Hi, everybody. This is the first time I've ever attended, so next time I'll dress a little better. Nice to meet you. Know your stuff very well. My name is Mark Zimmerman. I'm curious why we, Americans or Koreans or anybody, can't develop some kind of a weapon from space where we can just, like, laser shoot, pinpoint Kim Jong-il and just basically give him a disease that'll just put him out in 6 months or whatever so that we can get moving on this. Anybody have any idea? I don't know.
Thank you, Mark. Sir, please.
Hi, Brendan Mulvaney from the Army Directed Studies Office. I think you've kind of alluded to it a couple times, and the question about the sanctions brings to mind. With China's backing, I mean, how far can we actually push North Korea to actually reform? And it seems to me, I'm a China analyst, it doesn't seem to me that we have a lot of leverage over China, and China has not as much as we claim they do over DPRK. But as long as that relationship is intact, sanctions are great, and we need to do more, but is that really going to solve much?
Well, I think the sanctions can hurt them, especially when we're going after companies all over the world. They're not just using China. It seems, in looking at where a lot of these transshipments, the routes that they take, it seems like they often go in a freight container that goes through China now. Often they're not going on North Korean flagged ships. Of course, they didn't in the past either that much. But they don't use China as much except for that beginning transshipment as one might think. So I think getting other nations to go along with us will force China to kind of back off on allowing them to do some of this stuff, because if they're the only place, if Chinese ports are the only or Chinese airfields are the only places these shipments can go through, then it's going to really shine the light on China and be quite embarrassing for them, I think. Getting China to go along with us, just because it's the right thing to do, I absolutely agree with it. It's just not going to happen. They're just not going to do it. So I think that's very true. The Chinese will at least publicly not allow the North Koreans to do a lot of the things that they do, like drugs and illicit activities and proliferation. But they don't even control their own people that do that kind of thing. I mean, I don't know how many of you here have ever read Moises Naim's book, Illicit, and he estimates 8% of the Chinese economy is black market. That's huge, you know, and they just sort of look the other way. So if they're not doing that to their own people, why would they do it to the North Koreans? I think the crackdowns that we need to get are moving in the right direction. You know, I'm not putting down the Bush administration, but one of the biggest problems they had during that 2005 to 2007 time period when they were cracking down on Banco Delta Asia was they weren't getting any cooperation from the South Koreans. None. Zero. And they really weren't getting a lot of cooperation internationally as much as the United States is getting now. So I think we're moving in the right direction. I just think we can do more. And I think you've got the right idea, sir, in that going after the money is key, I think. And I need to answer the other two, right?
Cyber terrorism.
Okay, cyber terrorism. North Korea has, in the past year, really, come at least in channels I see, I don't read classified information, has, according to many sources in the Iraq press, and Hawan can probably talk to this, has conducted cyber attacks on South Korean military internet sites and on military installations, which, to be frank, was very surprising to me, because there are less than 10,000 people in North Korea who have free access to the internet. They are party members. You have to, this is no, I swear to you, I'm not exaggerating. To have access to the internet, you have to have a document stamped by Kim Jong-il, literally. They are that worried about information. So the fact that they have guys doing cyber terrorism, or if you want to call it cyber attacks, that's probably more accurate. That's how you said it. The fact that they have folks doing that, I think, is a relatively new development, at least that I've seen, and I think it's definitely something that that especially the ROKs need to focus on. Hope that helps.
Great. Thank you very much.
And taking out KCI, what was that movie? He was on a little to the left, Mr. Bricks. But I think that you do bring up one point in my mind, and that's when he is gone, the place just won't be the same. It really is a one-man rule society. They may hang on. They've surprised us in the past. I just don't see the possibility being real likely that that'll happen. Is that, I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Wait. Well, we'll certainly look forward to discussing the death ray after the program. We only have time for two more questions. The gentleman on my left, thank you very much for your patience, and Mr. Hateon of the Tonga Ilbo.
Thank you. My name is Xiaodong Xue, a Chinese non-proliferation analyst. First, one comment on the Chinese actions which relate to sanctions of DPRK, which, according to my knowledge, that the Chinese government has a very good cooperation with the U.S. government and also some European countries, which they have intelligence sharing, and also they already acted upon the request from their counterparts from the U.S., from the U.K., from you know, other governments, and to your understanding, they have done something, but those things are sensitive to be spoken out. You just cannot imagine first. One side you say we have done a lot, you know, against the DPRK, and then you go back to DPRK and saying that come back to Sikh Party talks, so we are friends. That's not possible. Yeah. So that's my understanding. Then one question for you, that is, according to your presentation, it's very much clear this country, DPRK, is a very much a failed state. Then the room left for diplomacy is very limited. It's like only wait and see for the collapse of the state. And that makes me quite confused. That's really, you know, so limited for the diplomacy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hateon.
Dr. Bechtol, you suggested that the North Korean provocation at this time is another limited provocation, and that means there will be no further escalation of tension in Korean Peninsula. So what is your speculation of next couple of weeks? What are you thinking about what will going on in the next couple of weeks in terms of, you mean, the further escalation or de-escalation?
Yes, please.
Excellent question from my good friend Ha Tae-won from the Dong-a Ilbo, and thank you for coming, sir, by the way. I agree with my friend Ha-won Lee, who said that it's been 12 hours since the attack, and I think the chances are not real likely that South Korea is going to actually bring about a retaliatory strike. I think if they'd done so within an hour or so afterwards, that would have made more sense. Although they may still do so. I mean, it hasn't been a full day yet, so they may still do so. If that does not happen, I could tell you one thing for sure. There will be another North Korean incident, violent incident, in the NLL. And we need to prepare ourselves for the fact that it's going to happen and that we need to, that the South Koreans need to react quickly. Because, as I said before, if you wait too long to react, with the world's attention, with the world's spotlight on you, it looks bad. So you really need to have, as I said, checklists, firm rules of engagement, and perhaps some flexibility for commanders on the scene, naval commanders, ROC Marine Corps commanders on those five UN-controlled islands. Because I'm not making any ingenious projection. This is just common sense. There will be another attack in the NLL. I don't know if it'll be an artillery attack or a naval attack, or even an aviation attack. But I think there will be another attack in the NLL. This is Kim Jong-il's pet rock. Does that answer your question, sir? Getting to the Chinese gentleman's statements, which were not questions, Chinese cooperation and counterproliferation. I don't believe that they are cooperating at the level that they could. If they were, then why don't they join PSI? You know, there's 96 member states in PSI. They're not in it, and I understand that they're sensitive to North Korea's wishes. But I would also say, and again, I hate to be blunt about this, but I would also say the reason that China is supportive of North Korea is because they like having that operational and strategic depth from U.S. forces on the Korean Peninsula that the DPRK gives them. That is a strategic issue for them, because it's not like they really embrace the form of government and society that North Korea currently has. That's just not the case. As for diplomacy, working with the Chinese on what will happen should North Korea collapse, I absolutely feel your pain, sir. I understand that China wants to work with us, at least I hope they do, I hear they do, on cooperation on what to do when North Korea collapses. Because in my view, what should happen if and when North Korea collapses, there will be a unified peninsula, a liberal democracy with its capital in Seoul. And the country that should take the lead on that should be South Korea, not the United States, and they will. That's already the plan as far as I know. Us and our allies, the South Koreans in the lead, should be talking to the Chinese about that, how they can cooperate, work together to make sure everybody is doing the right thing in the case of a collapse or implosion of the North Korean government. The problem with that I hear is that the Chinese have been reluctant, for exactly the reasons you mentioned, sir, on talking openly about this. But, I mean, one hopes that behind closed doors these talks are occurring. So I'm very positive about this. I'm hoping that that's what would exist. Done.
Thank you, Dr. Bechtol. I would like, first of all, if you had questions and I didn't give you an opportunity to ask those questions, please forgive me. Dr. Bechtol will be available after the event to answer any further questions. He will also be available for a book signing event. I would like to thank all of you here today for joining us. Mrs. Bechtol, we are delighted that you're also able to join us today. And Dr. Bechtol, thank you very much for a great presentation and for bringing such a great friend of KEI.